I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Today, we'll dive deeper into Baltimore's vacants-to-value effort. A recent report from the nonprofit Able Foundation concluded that the successes of the vacants-to-value program had been overstated by about 40%. Two deputy city housing commissioners are here to respond to the report. Who decides whether a vacant should be demolished or rehabbed? What influence can the neighborhood have? Then we welcome venture capitalist and philanthropist David Warnock, continuing our conversations with candidates for mayor of Baltimore. Call us with your questions as we talk about education. Warnock co-founded a charter school in West Baltimore, as well as transportation and strengthening community police relations. That's Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you're joining us. Later this hour, we'll be welcoming nonprofit executive and venture capitalist David Warnock to the show to talk about his campaign to win the Democratic nomination for mayor of Baltimore next spring. Over the next few months, we hope to speak with many candidates for Baltimore's top job, and we welcome your comments and questions for David Warnock. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Before we get to the campaign, though, we want to pursue a topic we started last week. On Friday, Nathan Sterner spoke to Joan Jacobson, the author of an investigative report for the nonprofit Able Foundation, on vacants to value, a city program started by Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake to reduce vacant properties across Baltimore. According to Jacobson's report, city housing officials, quote, created a false sense of the program's role in triggering the transformation of vacant properties, close quote. The city reported that about 1,585 vacant properties were renovated in the program's first 4 years. However, based on building permits for renovation, Jacobson found that nearly 300 houses listed as successes in the program were purchased by investors on the private market and had no involvement in the vacants-to-value program. Jacobson also found that in more than 200 cases, owners had no permits to prove that repairs were being made. Other properties claimed under vacants-to-value had actually been granted permits years before the program began. The real figure of renovated properties, according to Jacobson's report, is somewhere around 900 homes, not almost 1,600. So I'm joined now by phone by Deputy Housing Commissioners Julie Day and Michael Braverman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us, Sheila.
Good afternoon.
Thanks. Sorry.
I'm glad you're with us. So you heard me summarize Nathan's conversation from last Friday. What explains this discrepancy in the number of properties that have been renovated?
Well, if I could just start out, I would thank the Able Foundation and Bob Embry for their interest in vacants to value and for helping us, you know, unpack a little bit, see where it works, what we can improve, where it is working, where it's not working. And I think that fundamentally the tone of the report and the information in the report is something that, you know, we all agree on, that it's a lack of capital that's allowing us to expand the successes of vacants to value. So I'm looking forward to the opportunity to, you know, finding the common points and then, you know, looking a little more closely at the recommendations and some of the things that we think we can improve going forward because, you know, in large part and in many areas and based on the assessment of ABLE as well, you know, the program is the most ambitious in 40 years and that there is success in the areas where we're strategically applying, you know, the practices of vacants to value. And I think that the hundreds of people that attended the summit last week would concur with that. And the enthusiasm there was really overwhelming. I wish you had had the opportunity to be there with us. So we do know that there's room for improvement, but, you know, we're happy with the trends that we're seeing to date.
Okay. And Joan Jacobson told Nathan Sterner on our show last week, too, that that it's moving in the right direction, that where it's working, it does work, but there's such a discrepancy in the city's description of what it's accomplished compared to what she found that I'm not sure it's just saying there's not enough capital explains the discrepancy in accounting.
Well, you know, this is Michael Braverman. Good morning.
Hi, Michael.
Oh, good afternoon, actually.
Yes.
You know, I think I would start by saying the discrepancy that you just outlined was between, say, 900 or so or 1,600. So starting from the point of, you know, even if it was 900, you know, there would be, you know, an extraordinary forward motion that's, you know, transforming markets in the city of Baltimore. And that's a great thing. So if you want to get into quibbling on the numbers, you know, we do disagree with Abel's interpretation there. And but either way, I think it's really at the margins. But you talked about 300 houses purchased on the private market. I mean, I think there's fundamentally a misunderstanding about the role of vacancy value, or 200 houses that had nothing more than a use and occupancy permit. I don't think we ever said at any point in the program that there was a certain metric for the amount of money invested in the house. I mean, you can do a patch and paint on a vacant house. You know, you don't need a permit to put new kitchen cabinets in, to paint the house, to put new carpeting in. You don't need permits for any of that kind of work. But you are not legally allowed to occupy that board up until you get a use and occupancy permit. So the use and occupancy permit in those 200 cases, they were all granted. The house went from a house that cannot be legally occupied, most likely boarded, to a house that can now be legally occupied and for which a use and occupancy permit was obtained. So that's 200 houses that, you know, we think are appropriately counted in the program. And then for the role of, you know, houses that were purchased, I think the way the program was looked at, that it had to be a city sale or a citation issued or a receivership filed. But I think one of the successes of the program was the ability to change the climate of enforcement so that irrespective of whether any of those things happened, an owner understood, and I think this is one of the goals that we've had as a city for a long time, for people to feel like they can't sit on a vacant building in a market where we're active. And so if we issue a violation notice, and then we follow that with a letter explaining that we're going to issue a $900 citation, and then you sell the house to an investor, because that's, you know, in your best interest to do that rather than get a $900 citation, then that, again, you know, is, in our opinion, attributable to the enforcement climate that vacancy value created. So even if we weren't to quibble over those numbers, I think still the takeaway is we've had some extraordinary outcomes, and some markets are, you know, are really moving forward, certainly faster because of the program.
One of the recommendations of the Abel Foundation report is for an independent counsel to provide oversight of vacancy value. Right now, what kind of oversight exists to make sure that owners are actually making repairs and that the successes of the program are there?
Well, I would speak to the practice we have enhanced here in the Land Resources Division. We have a dedicated staff member who is monitoring compliance with all the disposition agreements, which are the sales contracts to convey city-owned properties for redevelopment. So we have a full-time staff person that is monitoring those for compliance.
Okay.
So I think that's something that we've enhanced of late and is working well.
That's been enhanced of late.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, the city decides to demolish properties rather than rehab or sell as is. But, of course, that can lead to vacant lot, and a vacant lot can attract some of the same problems as a vacant home or become a site, for example, for illegal dumping. How is the decision made to demolish versus rehab?
You know, I would say that, I mean, first of all, the reality is that, you know, there are 16,000 buildings with vacant building notices on them across the city. So, you know, and we're down 350,000 people, and our entire economic base has changed. So we are simply not going to absorb all the vacant buildings in the city of Baltimore. So demolition is going to have to be a critical component. And I think it's, you know, it's fantastic that under Mayor Rawlings-Blake we have enough demolition dollars committed so that we can do some strategic demolition. So the decision with limited dollars and an extraordinary need has to be strategic. So we're looking essentially for places where we can stabilize our existing homeowner base. So even in our most distressed markets, we have extraordinary pockets of home ownership. So doing demolition in areas that support their investment and can increase their equity is one driver. In other distressed areas, we're seeing investment and leveraging that investment by taking down, say, alley streets that are where those demolition investments are going to leverage rehabs on the principal streets to create some permanent green space or interim green space uses. These are all tactical, strategic decisions that are made in terms of how to handle those vacants. But we've committed, I couldn't agree with you more, and you know, it's a premise of the program, that getting an outcome that's not a rubble-strewn lot or, you know, a beacon for dumping, you know, is you know, as important as taking the houses down. And so, you know, the planning department, as part of Vacants to Value, is playing a phenomenal role in, you know, the program funds a planner that meets with communities and identifies the best reuse, which includes, I think Julie can speak to, you know, a phenomenal number of different ways that lot can be used to be an asset to the community. So we're looking at the back end at the same time, and you know, there's some extraordinary outcomes.
I want to pick up an issue that was discussed on the show last week. Nathan asked Joan Jacobson, the author of this Able Foundation report, he asked what the city is doing in order to prevent homes from becoming vacant, to prevent it from happening. Jacobson's first response was, quote, "I would argue they're doing very little," close quote. And she went on to describe how she believes vacants are created by the city's tax sale program, a law that requires the city to sell the liens of unpaid taxes and water bills to an investor. Jacobson gave us this example.
There's a house on Main Avenue in Howard Park in very far northwest Baltimore City. Large house, was divided into four apartments. They were all occupied. Owner did not pay the taxes. It was sold to tax sale, eventually foreclosed on. The judge signed an eviction notice for all the families in the built house. They were all evicted. I went back a year later, and the house was still empty. At that point, the deed was not recorded, and I called the original owner who lost it at tax sale, and he said that he was still getting violation notices for uncut grass for a lawn he didn't own anymore. So how does that help anybody? You know, the city needs to look at that system and find ways to correct it to prevent houses from going vacant.
She essentially said that the system that she's describing, there are lots of cases where there's not an owner of record because it hasn't been recorded. So what is the city doing to make sure that it isn't contributing to the number of vacants by pushing out residents who fall behind on their bills?
Well, the tax sale process is, you know, kind of fundamental to our budget. I mean, more than a third of the budget comes from property taxes. So the Department of Finance has a responsibility to do collection. I'm certain that the situation that Ms. Jacobson described is, you know, happens. I think that it happens rarely. And I think that based on, you know, the instructions that we've received from Mayor Rawlings Blake, that we have recently, you know, we've had a work group trying to look at ways to help owner occupants, particularly elderly owner occupants, to prevent their properties going into tax sale foreclosure. There are ways to engage in a payment plan for your taxes. There are ways to, you know, if the better the word gets out about a homeowner's tax credit, where it's income dependent how much property tax you have to pay, there are different ways to try to protect, you know, the most vulnerable in the city, and at the same time collect the revenue that we also, you know, we all depend on. Through our Land Resources Division, we do utilize tax sale foreclosure as a means of acquisition so that we can further development and have aggregation of development sites, but very strategically do we do that now. So there are a number. It's a complicated thing, and I know that the redemption rate currently being at 18%, so that if your property is sold at tax sale, you have to pay the liens plus 18%. We are going to be moving to have that reduced to 12%. So there are different things that definitely need to be fixed about that process, but I don't see it as, you know, the driver in creating vacancy.
We got a couple of questions on Friday that our guest then could not answer, and let me just sort of throw them at you rapid fire. hopefully they admit of short answers. Could some vacant properties be given or sold to organizations who work with the homeless population?
Certainly, we do that all the time. We will sell properties to whomever's able to, you know, have the wherewithal, both financial and experience, to bring about the rehab and use it for a purpose that's best for the community. We do that both through, you know, direct conveyance of city-owned properties and by the pre-qualifications of bidders who participate in the receivership program.
Are there any plans to rehab vacants and use them to use them for low-income housing?
Certainly. I mean, in fact, we were talking just last week about the nascent industry in the city of community land trust. There's Charm City Land Trust there. I mean, that could be a viable means to preserve affordability. But we have nonprofit partners all the time who you know, preserve affordability based on, you know, just their business model. We work with Empire and Enterprise and Ayers and different organizations, Greater Baltimore AHC. And all those organizations purchase properties both directly and through receivership to create affordable housing.
And lastly, are there any programs that match rehabbing efforts with people returning from prison to provide jobs or training in construction or demolition?
You know, one of the first things that jumps to mind is we just had an event with the mayor and the housing commissioner this morning about the deconstruction of the Julie 1600 block, 1500 block.
Yeah, 1700 block.
East North Avenue. But the point is that we just talked about the need for demo and the fact that the mayor has committed a significant amount of demo dollars so that we could do some strategic demolition, but we can also do that in a way that creates jobs. And so City of Baltimore is probably a national leader right now in doing demolition by deconstruction to both have job training, permanent jobs, and to build a whole industry around the waste stream materials. So I think we're doing some really exciting things in that regard.
Additionally, the mayor at the summit announced a new $6 million affordable housing fund that she's going to have on the ballot for the GO bond issues that need to be voted on by the electorate. So it encouraged people to vote in favor of the affordable housing fund that would be help provide more affordable housing. It's an important issue that we're all committed to.
Yeah, and I would just give a shout out to Humana, because what the city does is procure these services. And, you know, we have Julie mentioned some of our wonderful nonprofit partners who are providing affordable housing. And, you know, we have a great nonprofit partner in Humana, which won the procurement to provide these jobs and job training services through the demolition program.
Well, you've said the magic word of what people should vote for. That's what we need to devote the rest of the hour to. So I thank you both for joining us and wrapping up some of these questions. Michael Braverman and Julie Day, Deputy Housing Commissioners for the City of Baltimore, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Okay. Talk to
Bye-bye.
You soon.
Bye.
We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, mayoral candidate David Warnock is here. Send your questions midday at WYPR.org or give us a call at 410-662-8780. Stay tuned for that conversation. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. David L. Warnock is one of the latest candidates to join the race to be Baltimore's next mayor. Warnock is 57, founded his venture capital firm Camden Partners, one of Baltimore's largest private equity firms, 20 years ago. After a dozen years at T. Rowe Price, he was president of T. Rowe Price Strategic Partners. Warnock is also the former chair of the Greater Baltimore Committee, a business advocacy group. He has a bachelor's degree from the University of Delaware and a master's in finance from the University of Wisconsin. David Warnock has called himself a Baltimore success story and has said he's running to give back to his adopted home. Do you have questions for him? If so, give us a call, 410-662-8780. If it's long distance, call 866-661-9309, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. David Warnock, welcome back to Midday.
Great. Thank you, Sheila.
So why are you running to be mayor?
Yeah, I think this is the most important election in a generation. I think in many ways that this election will determine how we view ourselves, how we view this city, and in many ways how the world views us. And when I thought about my experience in the not-for-profit sector, having been the chairman of the Center for Urban Families for 15 years, having co-founded a charter school, Green Street Academy, the large number of companies that I've been involved with and growing and starting and building, I thought I had a duty and in some ways an obligation to step up and give my skills to the city.
What is the most important thing you think you would bring to the mayor's office?
Jobs. You know, I've been in the business of creating jobs for the last 20 years. In the venture capital business, you can see companies all around the city that I've been involved with, whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit businesses. And I mentioned the Center for Urban Families. We've had 10,000 people go through that program.
But tell us just a bit about it.
The Center for Urban Families is a magnificent organization led by an individual by the name of Joe Jones, who has been, I've been blessed to be his partner for a long, long time. It has its primary program is a program called Strive, which is a tough love program where about 70 people start at the beginning of the month and about 30 people finish. It's been a remarkable program because it's also led us into an understanding and an awareness of the collateral problems that people have in getting and staying in the workforce. You know, many of the things that I've been advocating, whether it's changes in our child support collection laws or our automatic expungement, have been lessons that I've learned at the Center for Urban Families, working with the people there, not only getting them jobs, getting them training, but coping with the things that are keeping them from getting ahead in the workforce.
But why do you think as mayor you'll be able to do more than you've been able to do in nonprofit work or in investing in companies that create jobs?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, because I think that our city needs someone right now that understands success, understands how to create jobs, because at the end of the day, we will have another uprising. There's just no question about it. If we can't create job outcomes, skill outcomes for the people in our city. And my familiarity through the Center for Urban Families, through Green Street Academy, the charter school that I co-founded over on Hilton Parkway, as well as the companies that I started, puts me in a position where I not only know how to start and build businesses. It was interesting listening to Julie Day and Mr. Braverman, who are really capable people, talk about the army of demolition and remediation people that are beginning to go to work in our city. My foundation, with a loan program, funded a company by the name of Green Job Works that currently employs 125 people in the demolition and remediation business. So my familiarity with how to build businesses, how to scale businesses, as well as a deep understanding of the things that keep people out of success, I think positions me as a very unique candidate going forward.
We are already getting calls for you. Why don't we take one right away? We've got James calling us from Park Heights. James, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon, Sheila.
Good afternoon.
I've been a city resident all my life. One of the major concerns that I have as a citizen that constantly is nagging at me is downtown is always getting redone. The neighborhoods is the reason the uprising occurred. It wasn't because of jobs. It was because you treated your neighborhoods like crap. Let's get real, okay? So when you talk about creating jobs, that doesn't do any good when a child walks past 20 abandoned homes on his way home from school. You got to rehabilitate the neighborhoods. If you don't put that first, and anybody We're still going to have another uprising, so don't delude yourself and anybody else behind that. You have to have common sense. My question is, do you have any common sense to understand that?
Well, James, let me invite you to come visit Green Street Academy, 125 North Hilton. We have 625 kids. We are going to transform that neighborhood. 60% of our kids walk to school. 15% of our kids don't have a permanent address. And 96% of our kids are on free and reduced lunch. And what we're doing there that's so exciting is a number of things, one of which is we're using a 125-foot-long greenhouse, a tilapia farm, free-range chickens, our solar panels. We're going to be using solar panels to generate electricity to run that school. Our kids worked with BG&E to figure out where to place those solar panels. We're also doing dual-generation skill training for the parents of our kids in the school. Now, as I said, 60% of our kids walk to school at Green Street Academy. So, you know, I think that I have walked the walk when it comes to understanding the needs to transform our neighborhoods. And I think your point is incredibly well taken. And, you know, I'm really excited about scaling the opportunities that we've created at Green Street and at the Center for Urban Families throughout the great neighborhoods of our city.
James, I appreciate your call. James called us on 410-662-8780 with his question for David Warnick. You can do that too, 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You helped raise more than $200,000 at the Greater Baltimore Committee right after the riot in April. How is that money being used?
That money was contributed to the BDC, mm-hmm. and that money is being used by the BDC for their efforts at
the Baltimore Development Corporation.
It is, at renovating and investing in our city. And it was a very exciting evening for me because I was able to do a couple of things. I was able to talk about social change and social issues. I was able to talk about expungement, our child support collection laws, as important issues that the business community needed to understand. You know, I've been a huge advocate, for example, of automatic expungement of non-convictions, both because it's a right that people have.
Spend a minute on that. Tell me what it means. It's a lot of long words right there, automatic expungement of non-convictions.
So in Baltimore City, a significant percentage of people who are charged with crimes are not convicted. We also have the most easily accessible database of convictions and charges of any state in the country. So, Sheila, you could look me up and find in less than 5 minutes if I had any charges or non-convictions, right? Thankfully, you would find that I don't. But employers look at that
sure.
before they hire, right? They look at that for every employee, right? And for a person that has a non-conviction of an offense, unless that non-conviction is expunged, it stays on the public record. And employers tend not to distinguish between a conviction and a charge. And so getting those non-convictions expunged, and again, we're talking non-convictions. The person was either found innocent, not prosecuted, steaded, right? But they were not convicted. Those non-convictions should not hold a person back in the economic marketplace. It costs money and it costs time to go through a court to get that done. It should be automatic.
One of the points of pressure against making it easier to expunge either minor convictions or, as you say, non-convictions was the Greater Baltimore Committee. I mean, the business community is not completely with you on making this much more easy for employers not to see about run-ins with the law.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that my point to the business community at the GBC annual meeting is that we are competing in a regional and, in fact, a global economy. And our workforce needs to look as good as it really is. And when we have people who have a right to expunge a non-conviction and don't have the money and don't have the feasibility to do it, one, it's not fair to them, but two, it also makes our workforce not look as skilled as it really is.
That's an interesting phrase to use about the workforce in Baltimore. Many people assume that the troubled neighborhoods we're talking about, the neighborhoods with endemic poverty and high unemployment, that businesses cannot find skills there. That's not your experience?
I would invite you to come over to the Center for Urban Families. You will find a membership, because we refer to the people that come through the Center for Urban Families as members. You will find a broad base of people who are motivated, who are quality people, who, yes, at times lack skills. And one of the things that we need to do is we need to invest in their skills. We need to help them get the skills necessary to compete in a regional economy. But there's no lack of heart. There's no lack of motivation in the city. I see it every day at Green Street. I see it every day at the Center for Urban Families. I see it every day at a company that I invested in and helped scale in the city that people see regularly, Town Park, the valet parking company. We have literally hundreds of employees in the city who are going to school part-time and valet parking part-time. It's an incredible company. There is no shortage of motivated, skilled people in this city. We need to help them get the additional skills that they have, and we need to help them remove the barriers that they have to get employment.
We've got more callers who want to talk to you, and I think we'll have more. But before we take a break, which we will need to do here in just a minute, I want to get your reaction to the Baltimore Sun University of Baltimore poll by OpinionWorks that was released yesterday. It shows, I'm sure you know, former Mayor Sheila Dixon with a wide lead, 24%, almost a 2-1 lead over State Senator Catherine Pugh, who has 13%. Councilman Carl Stokes, 11%. Councilman Nick Mosby, 10%. Attorney Elizabeth Embry, 7%. You were polling at 5%. What's your reaction?
I'm excited about having the kickoff of our campaign tonight, and I'll invite everybody to Lexington Market at 6:30. We'll have a great kickoff, and we will kick our campaign into gear. Our website goes live tonight, and I'm excited about engaging Baltimore in a dialogue about its future. I come back to my point that this is the most important election in a generation. This will truly frame how we view ourselves, how we view this city, and frankly, how the world views Baltimore. And we're kicking off our campaign tonight, and you will see us introduce a number of ideas that I think will be transformative for our city and that we can deliver on.
Okay, we'll have more questions after this break. We'd like you to be part of this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org with your questions or comments for David Warnock, running for the Democratic nomination to be mayor. He's with us the rest of the hour. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. Sheila Cast here, speaking with another candidate vying to be Baltimore's next mayor, David Warnock, managing partner and co-founder of the private equity firm Camden Partners, former chair of the Greater Baltimore Committee, an organization of business and civic leaders, and co-founder of a charter school, Green Street Academy. We have Mike calling from North Baltimore, who wants to talk to you about that. Mike, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. Hey, Ms. Cast, Mr. Warnock. Actually, you've answered my question about Green Street Academy with your description of some of the things going on. And as a retired city school person, I'm sensitive to that, and I'm glad to hear they're doing well. I wanted to ask, in terms of your candidacy, first of all, maybe it's already been said, what is your current family constitution, and what was the spark in the last year, I guess, that led you to believe that you should run for mayor?
Well, there's a number of questions there. Well, I have three kids, I have a daughter that's 27, a son that's 24, and a son that's off in college at that's 18. My son Evan will be working with me on the campaign. I'm excited about that. In terms of the decision to run for mayor, you know, it's interesting. I sat in the pew at Freddie Gray's funeral in April, and I was there really for three reasons. I was there as a citizen of our city. I was there in my capacity as the chairman of the Center for Urban Families. We were right across the street from New Shiloh. And I was there in my capacity as the chairman of the GBC because the business community was deeply affected by the uprising. And I, if nothing else, the legacy of Freddie Gray, in my opinion, which motivated me a great deal to get in this race, convinced me that we are absolutely in this together. That whether you're a business person whose restaurant was deeply hurt by the uprising and the perception that Baltimore is not a safe place to come, or you're a hoteler, or you're a person that's looking for a job, or someone trying to recruit someone to move here to work in a job, or you're one of our colleges that had a number of kids just walk away from their deposits because their parents didn't feel it safe to send them to Baltimore. I think the legacy of Freddie Gray, which really inspired me to run for mayor, was to engage the city in a dialogue about where we can go. And the fact is, we are in this all together. We will either move forward together as citizens of this great historic city, or we won't move forward at all. And it was that thought process, plus spending a lot of time with my pastor, Michael Phillips, that convinced me that I should put down a number of things and step up and run.
Mike, I appreciate your call. We also got an email from Eleanor, who wants to push a bit on your education experience. What systemic change has to occur in the Baltimore City public schools, she writes. What systemic change has to occur in the Baltimore City public school system to provide quality education for every student in Baltimore City, not just those in your charter school?
Well, let me say this about charters and in Baltimore City. You know, we operate at Green Street Academy using union teachers, using the same work rules as any other school in our city. Charters in our city are approved by our school board, and I completely support that. We have had a great experience with the Baltimore Teachers Union. And so the distinction between charters and traditional schools in Baltimore, in my opinion, is significantly overstated. Now, there are funding issues that need to be resolved, but the fact of the matter is that we play by the same rules. Now, with respect to moving education ahead in Baltimore, I would say a couple of things. One, that this election, again, is all about respect. And respect for the parents of our kids, respect for the taxpayers of our kids. And I will give you two examples of that respect. You know, Baltimore City Schools recently reported that they lost $3.6 million, just lost, on ghost employees and I think spouses that weren't spouses on the health care plan. That translates to me in 36 teachers, if you do the math at about $100,000 in total expenses a teacher. You know, we haven't had an audit of our municipal departments in Baltimore City since William Donald Schaefer was mayor. Imagine how many teachers we're going to find there when we finally get around to doing that. Now, that accountability, that will be job one on my part. But with respect to scaling programs, and there are a number of great programs in Baltimore City and our public schools, like Green Street Academy, we need to understand and meet kids where they are. Understand that they don't learn in a traditional instructor-led environment, and that they learn by doing things. That's been one of the primary lessons for us at Green Street Academy, that we can teach kids science and math and get them excited about a future. You know, one of the things we're really excited about at Green Street is adopting the Gwynns Falls, which is in our backyard, so that our kids not only learn about science science and math, they learn about the environment and the ecology and taking care of the city around them. So we can scale those programs if we meet kids where they are and we look after the accounting and the money of people who are investing in our great institutions.
Thank you for that response to Eleanor. Our first caller in this hour, James, essentially talked about lack of respect to the neighborhoods, and I think made a reference to the way police look at people in the neighborhoods. And I don't want this hour to get completely away from us without asking you how you, as mayor, would address the whole situation with community police relations. Kevin Davis was recently made permanent police chief. The murder rate is still climbing. We are at 309 murders this year, 34 in just the past 30 days. What would you do to address violent crime?
Well, let me talk from the heart for just a minute. You know, at Green Street Academy, we have had 4 kids since the beginning of the school year lose their fathers to gun violence in this city. We have 625 kids at our school. 4 of them have lost their dads in the last 2 months. So, you know, this is real. This is every day. One of the things that I plan to do is focus on making more and more community schools in our city, because educators today are being forced to deal with things that they are simply not equipped to deal with. Educating kids is a full-time job. But when you have kids that are losing their fathers to gun violence, right? Mm-hmm. We need to move the provision of behavioral care, health care, out of downtown to our schools. We need to focus on thinking of our schools as community schools, right? Now, with respect to our police, again, it's all about respect. Respect of our police for the people who they are paid to serve. One of the things that I will be very focused on is having more of our police live in the city. That's critically important, right? People, there's the estimates range, but between 10 and 20% of our police live in Baltimore. We need to create incentives, and we need to make sure that more of our cops live in the city.
And this would be by incentive or by fiat?
I don't think you can do it by fiat. We need to create incentives to do that.
What kind of incentives?
We have a lot of vacant houses in our city, right? We have a lot of vacant school buildings in our city. We need to create apartments. We need to create tax incentives. We need to have more of our cops live in the city. And let me talk to you about another initiative that I'm working on that I am really proud of and that we will be complete. It will be complete by the 4th of July. And again, it's all about respect. Our police officers, in my opinion, work in deplorable conditions. Any of the people listening ought to go visit one of our district offices. You will find the most dilapidated locker rooms. You'll find dilapidated bathrooms. You'll find dilapidated gyms. You'll find dilapidated offices, right? If I treated my employees at Camden Partners with the level of indifference that our police officers are treated in the place of their work, they would develop an indifferent attitude towards their customers as well. And let me tell you what we're doing in the Western District. I'm working with 2 great individuals, Andy Bertonini and Scott Plank, and we will be restoring the Western District. We think about it as the back of the house and the front of the house. So in the back of the house, we will be creating new lockers, a new gym, new offices for the cops. Now, parenthetically, I would say that the architectural footprint of most of the district police offices in Baltimore is similar, and we plan to roll this out throughout the city. But we will also be working on the front of the house. And again, this will be done with private funding by the 4th of July. In the front of the house, we will be creating a community room. We'll be creating a tot lot playground in front of the Western District. And we will be creating a park in front of the Western District that will have free Wi-Fi. We need to create situations that are safe for our citizens to sit and work and play and use free Wi-Fi. But we also need to get people who have gotten out of use to talking to each other to begin talking to each other again. And that Western District restoration, I think, is emblematic of exactly what I'd like to do in the whole city.
We have an email. I can't make out a name who raises a question that I think applies to several of your very interesting ideas. Where is the money going to come from to rebuild the most neglected neighborhoods in the city? Would you favor selling city assets to reinvest in troubled neighborhoods?
Well, there's no question that when we start doing audits, for the first time since William Donald Schaefer was the mayor, I'm willing to believe if we found $3.6 million at North Avenue, when we finally do audits that have been promised and, in fact, mandated of our municipal departments, we will probably find some money there as well. But the other thing that I'm looking forward to do is drawing together people like we're doing in the Western District, right? That is a privately funded initiative that will restore a public space. It's exactly what we did at Green Street Academy, right? We raised $20 million in bank financing and private funding to restore a great old building, the old 91, the old Gwynns Falls Middle School, where both William Donald Schaefer and Elijah Cummings went to middle school. So, we need to manage the affairs of our city with more respect for the shareholders, more respect for the taxpayers. We'll find the money to create these initiatives.
We have just a few minutes left. I think we have time to hear from Stephen in Baltimore. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hi. I've always lived in Baltimore, and I see it as two different places. There's the places like Canton and downtown that are simply gorgeous. And back in the early 80s, William Donald Schaefer made the promise that he would start on the harbor and then would roll out some of the resources to the neighborhoods. That has never come to pass. My taxes are higher or still as high, and I have less services in West Baltimore and the different places that I've lived outside of downtown. I still have to drive out to the county to get services. It's ridiculous that there's no businesses. The business strips have all gone. They're just horrible. What promise can you make individually to certain neighborhoods, specific things, to get us some service?
Stephen, thank you for the call. We have just a couple minutes.
Great question. You know, one of the things that I've said all along is that you cannot harvest the fruit of the Inner Harbor without planting seeds in East and West Baltimore. I fundamentally believe that the next mayor of this city needs to be beholden to no one but the citizens of Baltimore. Beholden to no one but the citizens of Baltimore. With respect to the specifics of what I plan to do, you know, one of the things that you will see in my administration is if you get a TIF or a pilot.
Tax breaks.
And if you look at the schematic of where those tax breaks are being given, right, as you probably know, most of those tax breaks go to areas around the Inner Harbor, right? If you get a TIF or a tax break in my administration, you get a rec center. You get a community school, right? We need to have a mayor that's strong enough to tie social contracts to financial contracts. And I mean that in a clear way. Our developers need to understand exactly what's being asked of them. But we need to have a mayor that's strong enough to say, you cannot harvest the fruit of the Inner Harbor without planting seeds in East and West Baltimore, and have enough experience creating opportunity to make that stick. And if you look at my background in business, you can see that I've built businesses, I've made hard decisions, and I will make it stick.
And that's where we have to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us. David Warnick. David Warnick is senior partner at Camden Partners former president of T. Rowe Price Strategic Partners. He's running for mayor in the Democratic primary next April. We'll speak to other candidates over the coming weeks. You can hear our interview with Carl Stokes at WIPR.org/midday. Lunch for today's midday guest provided by the Diz, located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo lump crab cakes. Open for lunch and dinner. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on weekends. On the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Tomorrow we'll discuss prospects of college for low-income and first-generation college students in Baltimore City and Prince George's County and the challenges they face. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned for Here and Now, and have a great afternoon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Dronberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.